Now, you heard me reference it a minute ago, but our study this morning is in the book of Ecclesiastes, and I'm going to read the last three verses of chapter 1 and the first 11 verses of chapter 2. Now, when I mentioned it with Matt, you may have found it a little bit strange, never heard of the book of Ecclesiastes being used in someone's story of coming to Jesus before. But as we read this, I think you'll see that the themes in this book are so universally felt by human beings that it shouldn't shock us at all that they connect with the deepest longings of our hearts. And in between the celebration of baptism and the celebration of the Lord's Supper that we'll do in a couple minutes, I want us to think for just a few minutes about how this happens, about how God connects with the deepest longings and desires of our hearts. Now, we obviously have no screens to sort of project the scripture reading onto this morning, and so you'll have to do one of two things. One, you'll have to open a Bible that you may have brought with you to Ecclesiastes, or pull it up on some sort of device, or you can do what the church did for hundreds of years before literacy was widespread and before the printing press made books common, and that is you'll have to listen carefully, one way or the other. If you're able to, let me invite you to stand as I read God's word. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, starting at verse 16. I said in my heart, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my heart has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge. And I applied my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is but a striving after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and he who increases knowledge increases sorrow. I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But behold, this also was vanity. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold of folly, till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made myself pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I had also great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the sons of man. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me, and whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had expended in doing it. And behold, all was vanity and a striving after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. This is the word of the Lord. Please be seated. Now, one of the things that makes Ecclesiastes so confusing at times to people is that it isn't exactly clear who wrote it. Now, strictly speaking, it's anonymous. It's not signed. There's no name attached to it. There's no proper name given. It's just the title at the beginning of the book, the title of the preacher. The preacher says. Now, traditional Christian scholarship would attribute it to King Solomon, and there's lots of good reasons to accept that as a thesis. And if we were doing a series on Ecclesiastes, then maybe we'd get into that debate a little bit. But one way or another, for our purposes here, let's just focus on something that is definitely true. The author, the preacher, is experiencing himself, or he's role-playing in some sort of sense, this great quest for purpose and meaning, this great quest for satisfaction. But at the same time, what he's finding is that the quest is extremely frustrating, right? What he calls a striving after wind. Right, the quest for elusive happiness that always seems to be just out of reach. All right, so what I want to do is I want to do three things as we look at this. And I actually want to start with, if you're looking at the outline, I want to start with what is point two in your outline. That is, I want us to see how this quest, at least how we often do it, how this quest fails us, how it is, as the preacher says, a striving after the wind. In other words, I want us to see the futility of the quest. Now, second, though, I want to validate the existence of the quest in the first place. In other words, while the way that we often pursue the quest is in fact futile, I want us to understand that you aren't crazy if you feel like you ought to be searching for something. That there is a validity to the quest. Now, finally, then, I want us to see how this leads us to something. How the quest does end in a satisfying way. I want to lead us actually to here and the celebration of the Lord's Supper. All right, first, the futility of the quest. Now, what is futility? If there is one primary point that the writer of Ecclesiastes is trying to get across, it's the concept of futility, the futility of man's search for satisfaction and meaning. All right, it's practically the theme verse of Ecclesiastes entirely. Chapter 1, verse 2 says this, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity." Now, we tend to think of vanity as kind of looking in the mirror too much or something like that. But what when we say something is done in, I'm sorry, I'm trying to get it loud enough for everyone and it not to move. When is something done in vain? Right? When we say something is in vain, what does that mean? All right? It means that it proves itself useless for the desired result. Something is done in vain. It's vanity when it's wasted effort. Right? When it's chasing something that can't be caught. That's that whole image of striving after wind. Think about it. It's a perfect image, right? How do you chase wind? You never catch it. Right? It's vanity. Right? It's no evidence that anything you did mattered. You pursue, and it's another image I thought of. It's like plowing the ocean. Like you could put a big plow behind your boat, right? Like you plow the ocean like a field or whatever. And what would happen? No matter how big the plow is, as soon as you pass by, right? I mean, the furrow that you made, it just fills in. It's gone. Vanity. Futility. Striving without reaching. Right? Working without result. Chasing things that don't deliver what they promise. Incredibly frustrating. And yet we keep looking, don't we? Right? Despite all the talk these days about an increased hesitancy for people to publicly identify themselves as affiliated with organized religion. And that's true. There is an increased hesitancy for people to publicly identify themselves with an institutional religion. But that doesn't mean that actually people are getting any less religious in this sense. In other words, it doesn't mean that people are abandoning their quest. It just means that they're increasingly looking in different places. And they aren't new places. As we look, in fact, if we look at the things that the preacher, the places where the preacher was looking to find satisfaction and meaning, right? We see that they're common. They're the same places that we look. Let's just go down the list of the things that are in the passage I just read, right? Where did the preacher look for meaning? Well, first, in chapter 1, verses 16 to 18, he looked for it in learning, in knowledge. We celebrate graduates today, and that's great. That's wonderful. Right? But the writer says that he acquired great wisdom, a great experience of knowledge. And if you use this, though, right, even this, even good as it is, if you use this as something that is going to deliver for you that satisfaction and meaning, right? In other words, he was trying to outlearn life, academic pursuit. He had devoted himself to it. He did all the reading. He talked to all the smart people. He thought all the big thoughts. And some of us can relate to that, maybe. Right? If we could just learn a little bit more, if we could just start our study maybe a little bit earlier in life, right? Get more graduate degrees, right? Immerse ourselves in the data, then maybe the answer to life will just pop out like some sort of algorithm. Right? But the problem, of course, is, and increasingly I think this is true, you can never know enough. Right? Ask anyone in academia. Right? In fact, the rate of knowledge today is increasing so rapidly that what used to be, you know, even just a few years ago, what used to be like relatively narrow fields now have subspecialties of subspecialties. It is impossible to learn all there is to know. Right? It's never ending. Now, some people take a different approach. The teacher tried this too. Look at chapter 2, verse 1. "Come now, I will test you with pleasure. enjoy yourself. And it's kind of funny the way he puts it, a test, like it's an experiment. Like, let's maximize pleasure. Let's try this. And this is, I mean, this is practically the national anthem of the American suburb, right? Right? Maximize pleasure wherever possible. Minimize pain wherever it might result. Seek every type of amusement that is available to you. Now, what's the problem with this? Problem here is you can't outrun pain. Eventually it'll find you. Life catches up with all of us. Verse three, he tries something else. He says, I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine. Well, you can check the industry stats or you can just look at your social media feed, but this strategy is certainly still around, right? Now, COVID messes with the data a little bit, but from what I could find, Americans consume about 1 billion gallons of wine every year. And that's up about 30% in just the last 10 years. And it's not just wine. I mean, that doesn't count all the people searching for happiness in all kinds of other beverages. All right, for example, my obsession with watered-down iced tea, that's not counted in the data. It's not there. Now, just to pick on wine for a second, because to the extent that it allows us to make a larger point here about things that are potentially addictive, right? What is addiction? I mean, there's a chemical component to it, no doubt about it. But spiritually speaking, what is addiction? Addiction is when someone believes the lie that the failure of the substance to produce the promise of happiness is because more of that substance is needed. You understand what I'm saying? Right? That's the spiritual aspect of addiction. It is the belief that whatever is promising you happiness, that the problem with it, the reason why it's not producing that happiness, is because you need more of it. And then you need more of it. And then you need more of it. That's the definition of futility and vanity. Skip down to verse 7, the beginning of verse 8, something else. What do you see here? Finding significance in the outward signs of wealth, right? The accumulation of servants. How big are your herds? How big are your flocks? Right? How much silver and gold do you have? Pretty common pursuits. What's wrong with them? Well, now, if by slaves that are being referenced there, if by slaves we're referring to the kind of chattel slavery that was practiced by the colonizing Europeans or in the American South, well, then there's a lot wrong with it. But as for just the accumulation of wealth itself, things in themselves, cattle, sheep, money, those things are morally neutral, right? But what makes them futile, what makes them vanity, is when you begin to believe, like with addiction, that just if you have just a little bit more of what you have now, it'll be enough. If I have just a little bit more. About 3 months ago, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal about the state of happiness in America. And there's always a bunch of articles every time, around this time of year, every year, when the World Happiness Report is issued. That's really a thing. There is a World Happiness Report. A bunch of foundations and other organizations fund a huge research project based on Gallup data to try to measure global happiness. And there's lots, actually, in a report like that that would be really fun to talk about. But what this reporter in the Wall Street Journal does is draw a very interesting conclusion about America. She writes, this is what she says, hundreds of studies, hundreds of businesses, books, courses, and mobile apps promise to help people be happy. But, she says, even though by many measures, wealth being the most notable, we as Americans are better off. Even though by most measures, wealth being the most notable, we're better off, Americans aren't happier. I know, blame COVID, right? No, that doesn't explain it. The research has been going on for years. 2020 was not an outlier. It's a continuation of a trend. What else? End of verse 8. What else does the preacher try to satisfy himself with? Singers, pleasure and entertainment, concubines, that would be wives of convenience, casual sex with women. You don't really have to make a commitment. Now, that sounds familiar. All right, I'll skip this for now. If you want to talk more about sex, then stick around for the next couple weeks as we go back to 1 Corinthians chapter 6. If you don't, then come back in July. But we'll talk more about that. Finally, verses 4 and 5. This is interesting. He says, I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks. I planted trees. Now, if you have the means, this is a very common way of searching for something of lasting significance. Right? You devote yourself to some great task, to a work, to a building project, to something great that will be your legacy. Andrew Carnegie, the founder of what became U.S. Steel, one of the wealthiest men in the world in the mid-1800s. He tried this. After amassing his fortune and not wanting his lasting legacy to be the accumulation of money on the backs of poorly paid, overworked, often boys at substandard wages, Andrew Carnegie, like many of the contemporaries of his time, the Rockefellers, the Morgans, the Vanderbilts, what did Andrew Carnegie do? He built things, right? And in Carnegie's case, he built libraries, more than 2,000 of them. He built libraries. And it continues today. In fact, I mean, this is just standard practice. If you're in financial development for a nonprofit, right? Give this much money and we'll name a building after you. We'll give you a wing or a brick on a path or something like that. All right, so there's the list. Or you could on each one of these things, you could spend an hour easy. You could do your own sermon series on any one of these things, but hopefully you see the overall point, the futility of the quest for satisfaction and happiness. The futility of looking for those things in learning, in pain-free living, in money, in wine, in women, in song, and all those things. And for the most part, like I said before, the things aren't bad in themselves. But if we look to them to provide satisfaction for us, then they'll fail. And what we'll do then is we'll move on to the next pursuit and the next pursuit. Until, for some of us who have either the resources or the lifespan or both of them, we try everything and it fails us and we throw up our hands in despair. All right, that's the first point, the futility of the quest. Now, but all is not lost because there is hope. Before we get to the hope, though, let's go back and acknowledge the validity of the quest. In other words, behind all of the futility, we need to remind ourselves that we are actually looking for a good thing, a very valid thing, right? But we just need to be honest about what we're looking for. Here's what I mean. Here's how I tend to think about cars, right? Now, I mean, people have different kind of approaches and philosophy, but here's how I tend to think about cars. I don't like, in general, spending lots of money on cars, but I could easily see how, up to a point, spending more money on a better car makes sense. For example, when my father's company relocated its headquarters, it suddenly required for him a significantly longer commute, right, and a lot more driving. So he decided to buy a very well-regarded car made by the Honda Corporation, right? I'll withhold the make and model because I'm not qualified nor interested in debating what car is better. Okay, but the point is, it was the kind of engine that one can easily drive for 200,000 miles, right, or more. Now, to me, if you have the money and there's a need, then it makes complete sense to spend twice as much money on a car if that car will last you at least twice as long. Now, consider, by contrast, the hand-built 2021 Aston Martin V12 Speedster, which will run you about $950,000. And so if you're Tom Haar, right, the math works like this. This is how you do it. You say, okay, if a new 2021 Honda Accord starts at about $25,000, and that'll get me, let's say, round numbers, 200,000 miles, then follow me here. If I'm buying the 2021 Aston Martin V12 Speedster for $950,000, that's 38 times the cost, then I'm expecting to drive that Aston Martin for 7,600,000 miles. But that's not how it works. In fact, if that's what I thought, I'd be completely missing the point. Even Motor Trend magazine says that if you're looking to buy the car in a sensible kind of way like that, you're thinking of it all wrong. Why? Right? Because at that point, and this is how it fits in, at that point, you're not buying a car, are you? You're buying art. You're buying something else. You're buying a feeling. Either how that makes you feel that you're able to buy something like that, or how it makes you feel because it's so beautiful and precise and well-crafted, whatever it is, you've moved out of the realm of practicality and into an existential kind of question. I'm not buying a car. I'm buying how the car makes me feel. Put it another way, there was an article in the New York Times Magazine about this is years ago, in the increased interest in luxury items for people that you wouldn't typically think, at least historically, would be buying luxury kind of items, right? Now, beyond just the incredibly rich, getting more and more into just normal people wanting to buy very expensive articles of clothing and things like that. And they were interviewing one of the makers of luxury clothing, and they asked him, they said, your sweaters cost 20 times more than other sweaters. And they seem to be pretty much the same thing. Are your sweaters really 20 times better? And this maker, he was incredibly honest. He said, look, he said, we sell dreams, okay? When you go into one of our boutiques and you buy lipstick or a sweater or something like that, it has the dream in it. How wonderfully honest, right? What are people looking for, right? What are we all looking for? We're looking for the dream. At a certain point, you're not looking for a sweater. You're not looking for a car. You're looking for a dream. You're searching for transcendence. And that is a very valid quest. That's a quest worth pursuing. Now, it will be completely futile if you try to find that in cars and in sweaters, but that's exactly the quest that you need. And anyone who continues to feel an emptiness in their lives when everything that they're using to try to find that dream, right, feels like it's just striving after the wind, right? Everyone who's looking for that needs to hear that what they're looking for, that the search for the dream is not crazy. You were made for that. C.S. Lewis, in the last chapter of his book, The Problem of Pain, he writes that there is something which we were born desiring, and which, beneath the flux of other desires, and in all the momentary silences between the louder passions, night and day, year by year, from childhood to old age, there's something that we're watching for, something we're listening for. This is what Lewis says. He says, you've never had it. All the things that you've ever deeply possessed, have been hints of it. Tantalizing glimpses, promises never quite fulfilled, echoes that died away just as they caught your ear. But he says, but if it should really become manifest, if there ever came an echo that did not die away, but swelled into the sound itself, then you would know it. Beyond all possibility of doubt, you would say, here at last is the thing I was made for. All of life's pursuits, if we think that they'll give us a sense of, that they'll give us and deliver that ultimate satisfaction, they're an echo. They're the wind. You'll never catch them. But there is an echo that will never die away. The writer of Ecclesiastes in chapter 3 says that God has put eternity in man's heart. And that's what Lewis is talking about. It's there. Paul says, the Apostle Paul in Romans chapter 2, that the work of God's law is written on our hearts and our consciences bear witness to it. In other words, the universality of the quest proves that there is an echo that we're chasing that leads us to the real sound. It can be found. And that's the completion of the quest. Have you ever done a really complicated maze? Either one of those corn mazes where you physically kind of walk around, or even just like a really complicated one on paper. I don't know, sometimes they're in the children's bulletin. There may be one today. You know, where you start here and you try to end here and you kind of go through. And particularly if it's a hard one, it can actually be very frustrating because you think you're on the right track and then boom, right? You hit a dead wall, a dead end. You hit a wall, right? Now you can think of that dead end in two ways. Right? You can either curse the dead end or you can praise the dead end. What do I mean? Why would you praise the dead end? Well, because you've just discovered another way that doesn't lead you to where you really want to go. That's what the author of Ecclesiastes is doing. He's taking us down all of these dead ends, and he's smashing us into the wall. And he's saying, look, none of this works. Cross that path off your list. If you have the bulletin, look at the other quote from C.S. Lewis that I've put on the front. This one's from his book, Mere Christianity. He says, if I find in myself a desire which no experience in this world can satisfy, the most probable explanation is that I was made for another world. If none of my earthly pleasures satisfy it, that does not prove the universe is a fraud. Probably, earthly pleasures were never meant to satisfy it, but only to arouse it, to suggest the real thing. You tired of striving after the wind? Working? Chasing after so many things that promise so much but can't deliver? That's not only frustrating, that quite literally is hell. At the end of Hebrews chapter 3 and the beginning of chapter 4, it describes those who find themselves on the outside of God's kingdom, right? Those who will not believe in the promise that God has offered through Jesus Christ. And do you know how it's described? The end of chapter 3, the beginning of Hebrews, at the end of chapter 3 of Hebrews and the beginning of chapter 4, you know how it's described? It's described as being unable to enter God's rest. Not able to enter his rest. No rest. Always looking but never finding. Always traveling but never arriving. Always on a quest but never completing it. That's hell. But there is a completion to the quest. Matthew chapter 11, Jesus said, "Come to me, all who labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you that rest." Now, how does that happen? It's here in the table in front of us. Right? As we transition to the celebration of the Lord's Supper, that's why Jesus gave us this sensory reminder of the gospel. The bread and the cup, the body and the blood of Jesus, the evidence of his efforts, the evidence of his work, of his striving that purchases our rest. See, Jesus not only points to the one who placed eternity in our hearts, his striving purchases the forgiveness that enables us to be in the presence of the one who placed that eternity in our hearts. He doesn't just point the way. He makes the way. He's the end of our striving.